This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Paul Hawken, environmentalist, entrepreneur, journalist, and best-selling author of six previous books, including Growing a Business, The Ecology of Commerce, and Natural Capitalism. Starting at age 20, Paul dedicated his life to sustainability and changing the relationship between business and the environment. His practice has included starting and running ecological businesses, writing and teaching about the impact of commerce on living systems, and consulting with governments and corporations on economic development, industrial ecology, and environmental policy. Paul Hawken is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Blessed Unrest: How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much.
What led you to write Blessed Unrest?
About 13, 14 years ago, during a period when I was giving a lot of speeches, I would meet people after the speech and they would give me their cards. It was that simple, and I would take them home after a week on the road, my pockets full, and put them on the kitchen table, read them, look at them, and then, not knowing what to do with them because I didn't want to throw them away, I put them in a drawer. And when I bought my houseboat, which is very small, I bought it with a housekeeper, and the housekeeper actually couldn't keep house because she was too old, but that's why we all employed her, because she had no retirement fund. So this was her retirement fund, everybody who employed her to clean their houses, even though she couldn't clean them. And so she would come, I could tell when she was at my house, because the house was always rearranged. She was an artist. And one day she took all the cards in the drawer because it was full, and she put them in a Gold LeMay Bergdorf Goodman bag with a white rope handle, and she put it in the closet. And when I woke up in the morning, and there was this bag of cards in my dressing room closet. And so then I began to put them in there, and when that bag filled up several thousand cards, I asked myself a question, which is, how many environmental and social justice groups are there in the world? And that's how this book began.
The movement that you describe in your book, how is it different from other social movements?
It's different in just about every possible way. We think of social movements usually as starting by an issue, but usually by a person, one or two, in some cases more, but usually a small group of people will start a movement and the movement will spread. But usually movements have an ideology, they have a strong belief system, they have centrality, they have hierarchy, they have control. And usually movements are started in order to address an imbalance of power, so that power is aggregated over to another group, another constituency. This group differs in virtually every way, which is that it has no leader. There's no charismatic white male vertebrate in charge, number one. Number two is that it didn't start in one place. There's no centrality. It's starting everywhere. It has started everywhere. It's everywhere in the world, every country, every culture, city, language, place. Third, it doesn't try to amalgamate power to itself, but is trying to disperse the pathological concentrations of power we see in business and government around the world and the military. And it is truly a bottom-up. And the reason it's a movement, however, is because if you look at the mission statements, the values, the purposes, that are the principles that inform the value statements that inform these organizations around the world, they're all different. But they don't contradict each other. They're not in conflict. And that's something we've never seen before. So I'm calling it a movement in a stipulative way, in the sense that it's a movement the likes of which we have never, ever seen before on Earth.
How would you characterize the aims and ideals of the movement?
I wouldn't. What I'm trying to do in the book is give a sense that there is millions and millions, tens of millions of people gathering around the world and so forth to address the salient issues of our time that are not being addressed successfully by government, and it's poverty and water and climate change and income polarization and deforestation and loss of oceans and loss of biosphere viability. And there is really hundreds of issues that these organizations are addressing, but in some, what they're doing is addressing the political economic system that is basically stealing the future and selling it in the present as profit or GDP. I'm not saying that as an anti-business statement. I'm just commenting directly that that's what is happening. We have an economic system that basically robs the future. And whether it's in the form of a clear-cut forest in British Columbia, or whether it's a clear-cut society in the form of exploiting children and workers or toxics in the workplace, we are exploiting the future in order to live the way we do in the present. And so that's what unites the social justice and environmental movement. The categories are very specific to place. They can be a river, they can be a riparian corridor, they can be mangroves, they can be coral reefs, but they can be human trafficking and women trafficking, they can be women's rights and women's health, they can be education, they can be senior rights, they can be all the plethora of issues that come under human rights itself and so forth. They can be democracy, they can be transparency, they can be governance. I mean, so the issues are multiple, but what unites them all really is this attempt by humanity to arise up and restore some semblance of grace and justice and beauty to this world that's being stripped away.
How large is this movement you describe?
Well, no one knows. That's why I started counting. When I started counting, I counted 30,000 organizations, which I thought was really big. And then it kept going up, 70,000, 100,000, 140,000, 150,000. And now we know that it's between 1 and 2 million organizations. It could be more. It is so large that there's no second place in terms of movements. It's over 100 million people working on behalf of others on a daily basis and full-time jobs, and it is also the fastest-growing movement in the world. But again, what's ironic about it is that it's a movement that doesn't know it's a movement. It has no name.
Could you say more about the conditions that have brought this movement forward?
Well, the conditions are planetary. They're social conditions and they're environmental conditions. And, you know, you can only do so much damage for so long before the feedback loops come into play. And when the feedback loops come into play, then people act. Usually they act on a local basis because there's been a local loss, you know. So a river lights on fire, aquifer disappears, a factory moves out of town, exploitation happens, and organizations will arise to address that, whether it's in Darfur or Dallas. And usually an organization arises because a government has failed. There's a good reason they're called non-governmental organizations, and there's a good reason why there's so many of them is because governmental organizations have really failed. And they have failed because of corruption. They've failed because they answer to money rather than to the people. They failed because the way in which they get elected itself is corrupted. So what you're seeing is citizens, in a sense, create a really grassroots democracy movement, which is sort of taking on the salient issues of our time and addressing them, not only in the way of resisting and trying to prevent further harm, but also in terms of trying to create solutions to what are seemingly the most intractable problems of our age.
Could you say just a few words about the historical roots of this movement?
Not a few. I could go on and on. It goes way back. We think maybe it started, you know, with Rachel Carson and the publication of Sun Spring, and certainly there was a big explosion of movements after the publication of that book. But it really goes way, way back to the Transcendentalists, goes back to the abolitionists, it goes back to the age of religiosity between 200 and 900 BCE, where you had the great sages and philosophers, you know, Socrates, Jeremiah, and Buddha, and Mencius, and Lao Tzu, and Confucius, and Patanjali. And if you really go back that far, you find the first expressions of an ethos, you know, of a moral life that called upon people to be respectful, to do no harm, and to help those they did not know and would never know. And the first expression of this in terms of a non-governmental organization as a charity, if you will, was the abolitionist movement started by Clarkson and Wilberforce and others in 1787 in London. And at that time, 3 out of 4 people in the world was enslaved or indentured. And yet, this group stood up and said, basically, this is morally wrong, the enslavement of people. And everybody ridiculed them because, like, what do you mean? This is what people do. They keep slaves. And they were marginalized, made fun of, denounced from Parliament, you know, denounced as progressives and liberals and do-gooders. We've heard those before. And said that they would ruin the UK, you know, that, in that time, the British economy by their foolishness. And, of course, history tells a different story.
How is this new movement that you describe in your book organized?
Well, we don't know. It's large. It's networked. There doesn't seem to be any analog or antecedent with which we can say it's just like. It's not just like. I will say that the advent of new communications technologies, texting, cell phones, internet, is having a very, very profound effect on it in terms of its connectivity, in terms of its growth, in terms of the ability of very small organizations to be quite effective in certain respects. So you're seeing now this real sort of brush fire growth around the world because you don't need to be a big organization to be effective anymore. But in terms of its organization, I think you have to go to biological metaphors to look how it's organized. You have to go to communities of life itself, communities of cells, before you find something that describes the interconnectedness and the intelligence that informs it.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Paul Hawken about his most recent book, Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. Why has no one seen this movement coming?
Well, because we look the other way. We, and all of us, we have to confess, we're looking for some great leader to arise, you know, and save us, politically, religiously, maybe some other Lee. But we are almost trained by default to look for a leader, you know, somebody of marvelous intelligence and heart and repute and goodness. And whether he or she comes from this country or some other country, that's what we look for. And we don't see that, in fact, humanity is organizing itself like some great immune system, an immune response to political corruption, economic disease, and ecological degradation, and that it's arising up everywhere at the same time, like grass or rain. In other words, it's ubiquitous. And that there is this great, great amount of leadership, except it's so widespread that we don't see it. We're looking in the wrong direction. We are doing what we want, but we're doing it in a collective way, and we're not doing it with the singularity that we have seen in past movements.
What do you see as the greatest strengths of the movement?
The strengths and weaknesses are the same thing, which is how many organizations there are. I mean, that is its strength. It's diverse, it's broad, it's resilient. There's failure. People try things, they don't work, they leave. New groups come in, it's easy entry. It doesn't take much to be able to start an NGO, a citizen-based organization. It takes more to be a philanthropist, of course, you know, to do a trust, but very little to do a network or collective or an alliance. And the strength of it is really the people themselves. There's a fierceness and a courageousness that you see in there in people. They've given up good positions, lucrative jobs, students coming out of college that could work on Wall Street or other places are turning away because they know that the most pressing issue of the century is really people on the planet, not profits. And that we do well, the rest we don't. So the strength of it really is the extraordinary people who are undertaking this task of restoring life on Earth, and not only life, but our cultures, our places, our cities, and our sense of connectedness with each other.
What are the special challenges of this type of movement?
Well, underfunding, overwork, underrecognition, low self-esteem, the feeling that it's your problem, that somehow you've got to save the Earth, which is, of course, a real tyranny, self-made. The fact that it doesn't necessarily lead to a career, it just leads to itself. All those are problems that plague it, but they, for most people who are in it, I guess for all of them, they outweigh the pleasures and the gifts and the joy of doing it. It's not easy. In many places in the world, people are killed in this movement. They're threatened every day. We have it easy in this country. We didn't during the Civil Rights Movement. There was such a time when people were killed and threatened, but by and large, in this country, with respect to environment and social justice, you know, it's not a dangerous movement to be in. That's simply not true in most of the rest of the world. The first leaders of a movement, NGO in China to stop trafficking endangered animals, the first two leaders were killed and, you know, assassinated. So, you know, there's Chico Mendez and Stephen Biko. There's many examples of people who have been killed, and many we don't know, don't hear about, but the raw courage that you see in people around the world, celebrated every year in the Goldman Awards, you see people who are just really spectacular in what they've faced and what they've done and what they've confronted. But for everyone we see, there's another, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands that we don't hear about.
What is the likelihood that this type of movement that is so diverse, how can it be effective at a larger scale and address issues such as climate change?
Well, the movement has been effective because the movement started addressing climate change in the 70s. And the discussion that's going about today is driven by both the movement and science. Science, for sure, no question about it. But a lot of the science, like union concerned scientists, is part of the movement. That is to say, that's where the science came from. Not all of it. So the effectiveness of this movement isn't to be necessarily the UN or, you know, some large institution and to amalgamate. The effectiveness of this movement can be measured by its ability to push ideas and permeate ideas into other institutions, into government, into business, into religion, into education. And many of these ideas, many of these memes, if you'll, start in the nonprofit world. And again, just like the abolitionists are seen as sort of frivolous or marginal or, you know, outside, you know, the mainstream. But time repeatedly has shown that, in fact, these are people who are ahead of their time, and they were progressive in every way the word means something and implies, and that they are making progress. That is, they're trying to help us progress, you know, instead of regress. And so oftentimes the civil society, this movement doesn't get credit for what it does, because finally when something happens, somebody else, you know, grabs a baton and puts on a, you know, a little little sequin suit and gets in front of the parade and starts twirling it and leads the parade. But and that's okay. But the fact is that a lot of the heavy lifting, a lot of the work was done years and decades before that by, you know, groups that we now forget.
Are there specific groups you would say are really not part of this movement?
Well, we've done a website called wiserearth.org, and we did exclude groups that use any type of force to coerce others, whether it's psychological coercion or physical or economic. So it's not about forcing others to believe or think or do anything. It's really about ideas, about education, about possibility, about solutions. So we definitely excluded those organizations.
In your view, how effective has this movement been so far?
Well, my metaphor is the immune system, as I said, and effectiveness has to be counterbalanced by time, which is that this movement is a response, and the momentum of the forces that are causing damage is far greater than the momentum of this movement. So you can easily take a snapshot and say, wow, the movement is losing, you know, the movement isn't effective because the rate of damage is increasing faster than the rate of response. But I would say that although that is true and has been true, I would say that the rate of response now is increasing faster than the rate of damage. And though it still is outgunned, if you will, by the damage we see both socially and environmentally in the world, I'd say right now that this is, like I said, not only the biggest but fastest growing movement. And I think we're seeing a real sea change in the world. And I think if we, again, trace it back, we'll go right back to this nonprofit civil society world that has been propagating these ideas for a long time.
What are your thoughts on the types of groups that are most effective?
I think they're all effective depending on what they do, where they are, what they address, and how they're organized. So I don't think there is, you know, more, I mean, you can look at an issue and at one time, at one point, and this group might be very effective and might get credit for it, but I just don't see it that way, no more than, you know, which cell in your body is most effective. I mean, it's a community. And I see this movement as a community, you know, and what I see now is that because of technologies, the ones we mentioned earlier, this community is getting better organized, better connected. It's collaborating more. It's working more effectively as small organizations in terms of amalgamating their efforts into more singular or more collected efforts. And that itself is more effective. But I don't see one group as being more effective. I certainly see ineffective groups. Yeah.
Could you comment on some of the groups that have come together to try to work on issues?
Well, Seattle is a case in point. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a perfect... In fact, the Seattle really, there was two things. One is the closet and the cards in the bag. The second precipitating event for me to write the book was Seattle, because I was here. And Seattle is when the NGO world belled the cat of economic fundamentalism, basically. And it could no longer go anywhere in the world without having a whole bunch of people outside the hotel and the meeting halls and the conference rooms basically saying that the stakeholder process was not inclusive and that the people of the world were not at the table, so therefore the process is invalid. But the thing that struck me, and I wrote a piece about it called N30, and it was published widely throughout the world, but the thing in my research that struck me, which I did not put in the article, was that the organizational methodology that was used and employed in Seattle really went back to 1990 and 1992, the encuentros in Quito, Ecuador, where the first peoples of North and South America first met since the conquest and first got together. And they used a kind of a Mayan organizational scheme, if you will, which was employed in Seattle. And I realized that at that time I was counting, but then I realized that there was this sort of permeation, you know, across borders and languages, you know, of of processes and means and so forth. And that's when I really decided to write this book. That was after Seattle.
What has this movement accomplished so far?
1,000 things, 1,000,000 things. I mean, its accomplishments are everywhere you go, in this town, outside of town, every forest, river, beach, place, everywhere you see the accomplishments of this movement. It is so pervasive in this culture and society that we take it for granted. You know, the change of consciousness, awareness, what we do, what we don't do, how we do it, what we see, what we haven't lost, the new rules, regulations, education, curriculum, what our kids know, what we see, what's happening in our companies, our factories, our businesses, and our churches, all goes back down to this movement.
So at what point does this movement cause the type of change that's needed to make our society really transform?
It's doing it right now. That's what it's doing. And there is no point. There is no point. It's as if during the Cold War, you know, you could have a stand down, people could sit down somewhere and, you know, exchange pens and sign something, and it was the end of the Cold War. But this is a war with ourselves. There is no point, you know. Again, it's like charismatic leaders. There is no leaders that can do that. We can only do it person by person, community by community, issue by issue. We can't do it on some hierarchical top-down level. That's what's caused the problems. So it's not going to be the solution. So we can't look for an omega point.
How do you see the movement you describe changing over time?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a describer of it, not a prescriber. You know, I'm not prognosticating. I will say, as I have said, that the last 10, 12 years have seen it change very rapidly because of communication technologies, and you're seeing the capacity and the ability and the willingness to connect in a way that was not possible before. And even if it was possible in certain ways, it was very expensive, and now it's very inexpensive. It almost costs nothing. And so that is having a big effect on the movement itself. But, you know, I'm loath to predict what's going to happen, how it's going to happen, because I know I'll be wrong.
What do you think is most needed for this movement to bring about the positive changes in our society that they're attempting to accomplish?
You know, it's an interesting question. I wouldn't exactly disaggregate the movement from society. This movement is society. This is an expression of people in every culture, language, place in the world. And this is society expressing itself, and it's expressing itself how and where it can, because so much of what it needs and wants is really not listened to and not responded to by local civic organizations, by state and national and even international bodies. And so what you're seeing, it's not a movement apart from society. It's not separate from society. It's made of nuns and grandmothers and farmers and poets and schoolchildren and engineers and doctors and grieving Muslims and devout Buddhists and, you know, and peaceful Christians. I mean, everybody's a part of this movement. It's not like a special little group of people someplace. So therefore, you can't really answer that question as if there was two different things there. This is an aspect of society that's growing faster than any aspect of society that we know of.
Would you like to comment on the resources available in the appendix of your book and also the website you have launched?
The back of the book consists of what we call areas of focus, but what it was, or is really, is as we went to organizations and we created Wiser Earth, which is really a wiki, community-owned, open-source, editable, a listing of organizations, people, jobs, events in the world that relate to the environment and social justice. As we did so, we would look at organizations' websites or annual reports to try to determine what they do so that we could create a taxonomy, if you will. And we were amazed, in a sense, at what this movement does. It's like art and pornography. You know it when you see it, sort of thing. And I think people do when they see the movement. They know this is, okay, environment, and this is social justice. But the fact is that there is no true environmental or social justice organization. They're more specific than that. They address specific issues. And so we tried to make a list of those issues. In the back of the book is a list of them, the definitions, tags, keywords, and then numbers next to them, giving the number of organizations that are in wiserearth.org at the time of publishing, which is lower then, of course, than it is now, because it grows every day. And I really encourage your listeners to log on and look at it, and if they want to become editors and start to add and create content and copy, then to create a personal login or profile and jump in. It's community-owned. It's community-driven. I mean, we created it for sure, but we turned it over to the community 23 days ago, and we're in there with you.
What's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message is that we're moving from a world created by privilege and to a world created by community. And that's a huge transition in the 21st century. And although it's going to be the stroke of midnight for the rest of our lives because of what we precipitated in the 20th century, I do think that we're seeing a massive change in the locus of power in the world. And it's coming from people, it's coming from organizations, it's coming from citizens everywhere who actually want to create a world that their children can live in.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Paul.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Paul Hawken about his book, Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming, published in 2007 by Viking Press, a member of the Penguin Group, Incorporated. For more information, check on the web at www.paulhawken.com. That's H-A-W-K-E-N. And also wiserearth.org. Again, that's paulhawken.com and wiserearth.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.